Good morning, everyone. You're listening to the World Teacher Programme for Share International New Zealand on Planet FM 104.6. Each Friday morning, we bring you information from the teachers of the Ageless Wisdom. The purpose of our programme is to introduce Maitreya, the world teacher for the Age of Aquarius. Maitreya does not come alone. He brings with him the Masters of Wisdom, a group of highly evolved teachers. They work in many fields and can teach us the art of living, how to live in right relationship with each other. With their inspiration, we can transform our civilization, creating justice and peace for us all.
Good morning, everyone. As circumstances force us to become more responsible about climate change and the survival of our planet, we have decided to read a short reminder from the Master about the situation we find ourselves in. We have a short article about water conservation in the Himalayas and a further one about the first 100 days of the first term presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Let's start with an excerpt of the Master's message, April 2009.
And the heading is The Curse of Commercialization. If men are to save this planet from the results of global warming, they must do infinitely more than is planned to limit carbon emissions, and in a short period of time than is generally accepted as necessary. Men have been slow to recognize the dangers, and even now, many refuse to take the problem seriously. Such attitudes, there is no doubt, put in jeopardy the future of planet Earth. At most, men have 10 to 15 years in which to establish a balance before irreparable damage is done. To achieve this goal, men must change dramatically the present way of life and embrace simpler forms of living and working. Gone are the days in which men raped and ravaged the planet at will, without thought for the generations still to come. Neither seeing nor caring for the environment, which is gradually and inevitably decayed. Each year, and for many years, huge areas of ancient primal forest are cleared of life-giving trees for purely commercial benefits. Commercialization indeed bodes ill for humanity as it tightens its grip on the throats of men. Commercialization, says Maitreya, is more dangerous to men than the atomic bomb, and is showing its destructive power in the economic chaos which rules in the world today. How long will it take governments and their peoples to see this? How long till commercialization squeezes the lifeblood out of humanity and itself withers and dies? More and more, the truth of these words is born on the minds of millions who now suddenly are jobless and homeless and in despair.
And now we come to the article about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days, and it's written by Eliza Gruff, titled A Standard for Leadership That No One Since Has Matched. I'd like to start with a quote that he made. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. The first 100 days of a first-term presidency of a president of the United States are considered an important measure of the successes and accomplishments of a president, as during this time it is believed that the president's power and influence are at their greatest. President Trump publicly declared in April that compared to his own presidency, no administration has accomplished more in the first 90 days. Comparisons are said to be odious, but are often revealing. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who coined the expression, first 100 days. And it was the remarkable achievements of his first 100 days in office, enacting 76 bills into law, 15 of which are legislative landmarks, that set the benchmark against which all presidents are judged today. The United States has never had another leader like Franklin D. Roosevelt, notes Kenneth T. Walsh in the U.S. News and World Report. Serving for 12 years, far longer than any other president, he had such a profound impact on the nation and the world that he is widely recognized as one of the transformational figures of the 20th century and one of America's best presidents. Walsh adds that one of Roosevelt's most important attributes as a leader was his capacity to empathize with his fellow citizens, to show that he cared about them and would do everything he could to help them. This enhances political power by connecting him irrevocably to everyday people, says Walsh. It's something that presidents have tried to do ever since, but few have accomplished it as well as Roosevelt. Roosevelt had contracted polio in 1921 at the age of 39 and never again regained the use of his paralyzed legs. His wife Eleanor said that this experience of struggling and failing to conquer the disease broke him out of the isolation of his upper-class background as someone who had lived a life of ease and privilege, notes Walsh. It was during the tumultuous period of the Great Depression in January 1933 that he took office, and his immediate legislative efforts were aimed at bringing much-needed stability to the American economy and remedying the sense of despair gripping the nation. These were trying times for a new president, Zach Carter writes in the Huffington Post. This was no mere economic calamity. The American political project appeared to be in its death throes. Thousands of bank failures reduced millions of middle-class Americans to sudden, shocking poverty, while families migrated from town to town looking for work as factories were shuttered across the country. Farmers as far-flung as the Dakotas, Tennessee, and New York, notes Carter, had taken over highways, physically blocking transport of meats and vegetables in a desperate bid to raise food prices. In a few weeks, a judge in Lamar's, Iowa, presiding over 15 farm foreclosure cases, would be dragged from his courtroom with a rope around his neck. With this stark backdrop, Roosevelt's first order of business upon taking office, explains Zach Carter, was to declare a bank holiday, closing every bank in the country and dispatching inspectors to thoroughly examine all books and accounts. Through an act of legislation called the Emergency Banking Act, the federal government agreed to meet the liabilities for any solvent bank. A few days later, when banks were then reopened, depositors were able to withdraw funds, preventing public panic. By mid-June of the same year, says Carter, the threat of revolution would be gone. The American presidency would be redefined and the federal government's role in civic life overhauled under a political realignment unlike anything since the Civil War. The power of big business would be subjugated to the voting public for decades to come. In those initial months, Roosevelt signed into law legislation that rescued the financial system through sweeping new banking reforms, protected families from foreclosure, provided aid to farmers and laid off factory workers, and created new government agencies that directly employed people desperate for jobs. And I'm going to finalize with another quote from F.D. Roosevelt. Human kindness has never weakened the stamina or softened the fiber of a free people. A nation does not have to be cruel to be tough.
And the article continues, in order to put millions of young men to work and to shore up environmental conservation efforts, Roosevelt founded the Civilian Conservation Corps, as well as the Public Works Administration, to construct schools, dams, airports, and other infrastructure. He instituted the Tennessee Valley Authority, which brought electricity to much of the South, and created a hedge against predatory monopolies in the power market. To ensure that citizens' savings were protected from bank failures, Roosevelt established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corps, still doing its job today, most notably during the financial crises of 2008-2009. The Securities and Exchange Commission was created to protect investors from corporate fraud, to protect traditional banking from risky securities trading. Roosevelt instituted the Glass-Steagall Act, which Carter notes would put an end to U.S. banking panics for 50 years. Although these projects began in those first 100 days would take years to implement, Carter says the furious pace of activity helped calm an anxious public. Today, he notes, many of these ideas and institutions are considered a normal part of governing. Even the most ardent conservatives don't talk seriously about eliminating the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Tennessee Valley Authority remains one of the largest U.S. producers of electricity. While progressive and populist reformers had been clamoring for these policies for years, Carter explains that they had no academic or intellectual support for their agenda. Roosevelt financed his project by taking the United States off the gold standard, a radical change to the country's monetary system that conservatives derided as communist well into the 1950s, and by borrowing and printing money. Though Roosevelt's policies did not have the support of the captains of industry at the time, his strong agenda helped the economy rebound even before the spending he had approved actually began flowing into the economy. Roosevelt's first 100 days revived business confidence, as is shown by the remarkable recovery of production, which took place without fiscal stimulus during the second quarter of 1933, comments economic historian Robert Skidelsky. When Roosevelt died at the age of 63 of a cerebral hemorrhage at his Warm Springs, Georgia vacation home on 12th of April 1945, writes Kenneth Walsh, immense grief spread across the country. It was only a few weeks after he'd been sworn in for an unprecedented fourth term, and many Americans wondered if anyone could replace him. Walsh shares a telling anecdote. As his funeral train made its way across the nation, a man was found weeping along the route and was asked if he'd known Franklin Roosevelt. "I didn't know him," the man replied, "but he knew me. This was a feeling shared by millions of Americans, and that article was sourced from the HuffingtonPost.com.
And now we come to an article from our Save Our Planet, and it is titled, Reglaciation Creates Ice Stupors. Himalayan glaciers are reservoirs in the sky, yielding vital meltwater on which all life depends. In the high Karakoram Desert region of Ladakh, northern India, glacial water swells the Indus River and boosts the scant 50 millimetre of rainfall a year. 80% of their water is provided by Drangdrong Glacier, which is receding at a rapid rate and no longer yields the volumes needed to recharge ground water tanks. Siwang Dolma is an environmental scientist from Clark University, Worcester, UK, who has studied the effects of climate change on the mountain community in Ware, the capital of Ladakh. In the crucial spring months of April and May, local streams now run dry when farmers most need water for newly planted crops. You will see people literally fighting over water, she said. The situation is getting worse by the day. Local engineer Sonam Wangchuk has devised an innovative solution to create artificial glaciers by refreezing wasted glacial runoff in late winter and storing it in ice stupas, whose shape echoes traditional Buddhist mud stupas. These ice pyramids gradually melt and supply water throughout spring. The project was spearheaded by SEMCOL, Alternative Institute, in cooperation with the Feiyang Monastery. We wanted to achieve two things, said Wang Chung, to show how to make a stupa and how to green a patch of desert. We want to create orchards and greenhouses for vegetables. This is an economic as well as ecological activity. Utilizing only the force of gravity, meltwater is piped downhill, thereby developing a head of pressure. Then the water is channeled vertically and sprayed high into frigid air of minus 20 degrees Celsius. The water falls and crystallizes over loose piles of prickly buckthorn trees gathered by local people. Each night, more meltwater is released to add new layers of precious ice to the stupa. The design is critical as the stupa must have a minimum surface area to provide maximum protection from the sun, thereby lasting up to 4 months. If the same volume of ice was stored in a flat glacier, it would melt within days. 2 million litres of water can be stored in a 30-metre-high ice stupa built on waterproof clay, so water does not seep away into the desert sands. Once the pipes are laid, ice stupas can be built year after year at no additional cost, ideally with reservoirs to store water. In 1988, Wangchuk founded the Environmental Mountain School, where he now teaches local students how to create ice stupas. He said, the people who will be running this world in the next 40 or 50 years are now in schools and colleges. I want to engage them in these innovative ways to be sensitive to the environment and the mountains so the earth could be in safe hands.
And now, a short message from Benjamin Cramp's book, My Transmission, Volume 2. The voice of the people is already beginning to be heard, and this representative form of government will replace control of the masses through ideology. Everything is moving so fast now that events are beyond the control of the politicians. A new political era has begun. Awareness awakens people to their basic human rights, their liberties, and their responsibilities to themselves and each other. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening. If you would like further information, you can write to us at Box 34491, Birkenhead. Love and blessings all.